Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Well, greetings again. This is Bob Mallon, Audio Information Network of Colorado, with today's edition of Military News. Let's get started with an article entitled, "These Marines Drank Camp Lejeune Poison. The Road to Justice is Long." Posted 21 May 2023, McClatchy, Washington Bureau, by Danielle Battaglia. John Plumovo wasn't told the danger she was in when she stepped under the showerhead in her bathroom in Jacksonville, North Carolina. She wasn't told about the toxins mixing into her daughter's food every time she blended formula with water from the kitchen sink, or that cooking her own food in that same water would eventually lead to her death. Plumbo didn't know that beginning in 1953, toxic chemicals had begun seeping through the ground into two of the 8 water treatment plants on Camp Lejeune. The Marine Corps base near Jacksonville, where she and her husband Fred lived in the Tarawa Terrace neighborhood. Triethyl chlorine, perchloroethylene, benzene, and vinyl chloride, deadly chemicals known to cause health problems, including miscarriages, birth defects, cancer, and childhood leukemia. They leaked from underground fuel storage tanks, an off-base dry cleaning facility, industrial area spills, and waste disposal sites. The contamination of the base's water continued through 1987 and mostly affected the Tarawa Terrace and Hadnot Point neighborhoods. It is estimated that more than 1 million people were likely exposed to the toxic waters on Camp Lejeune. Beginning in August, half of these people had filed claims asking for the government to make right what happened to the Marines and their families. But no offers from the government have been extended, and without those offers, the claimants have been forced into litigation, potentially for years, if they want justice. Palumbo is among those people. The Palumbos moved in 1962 to Camp Lejeune and together had their first child. Fred deployed overseas in 1963. Subtle signs include miscarriages and premature births. The first signs of trouble from the Palumbo family from drinking Lejeune water were subtle. While Fred was serving across the world from his wife, Joan suffered a miscarriage. The same year, Joan became pregnant, this time with twin daughters. They were born 3 months premature and entered the world fighting for their lives. The Palumbo's daughter, Christine, died after 3 days on New Year's Day. Her sister's fight continued for 6 long months before she was able to leave the hospital and join the rest of her family at home. The Palumbos went on to have 6 children, and it seemed that tragedy had left them. When the youngest entered grade school, Joan Palumbo returned to her job as a pediatric nurse. She would eventually become a psychiatric nurse. Fred continued serving in the Marines until retiring in August 1981. Less than subtle signs: breast cancer and multiple myeloma. Then, in 1997, Joan's own health took a drastic turn. Her husband calls it her medical nightmare. Breast cancer led to a lumpectomy in her right breast. Another lump in her left breast led to bilateral mastectomy. Then she needed a spinal fusion. A new diagnosis, multiple myeloma. She had a mitral valve in her heart replaced. Then she went into renal failure. If all of that wasn't bad enough, she was inflicted with shingles before her death in 2011. Learning about Camp Lejeune's contaminated water. Fred Palumbo told McClatchy he and his wife pored through her family's medical history. Heart problems and cancer were not part of their story. Nothing made sense. We couldn't determine what the problem was, Palumbo said, and I didn't realize there was a problem until after she died. He can't remember exactly how he learned about the water contamination. He believes it was a news segment on television that led him to connect with Jerry Eisminger. Eisminger, a retired Marine, has become the face of the fight for justice for those who lived and worked on Camp Lejeune. Eisminger lost his 9-year-old daughter born on the base, Janie, to leukemia in 1986. Eisminger led efforts to uncover what happened with the water on the North Carolina base. Hold the government accountable for covering up the contamination and ensure that no one who served at Camp Lejeune was left in the dark. Fighting for Justice and the PACT Act. Eisminger spent decades traveling to Washington fighting for the government to take responsibility for what happened to his fellow Marine Corps at Camp Lejeune. In 2012, President Barack Obama signed into law the Janie Eisminger Act, which ensured family members of veterans who lived on Camp Lejeune during the years of the water contaminations had access to health care. Last summer, Eisminger's "Oorah," the Marines' battle cry, echoed in the Senate chamber when Congress passed the PACT Act, giving anyone exposed to and affected by the water on Camp Lejeune 2 years to file claims with the U.S. Navy. The bill also allowed service members to file claims if they were exposed during specific dates to burn pits, which is a form of waste disposal that can give off toxic fumes, or if they had illnesses connected to service in the Gulf War, Southwest Asia, or the Vietnam War. More than 500,000 claims have been filed because of the PACT Act, Biden announced on April 26. The claims detail when someone was on the base, their exposure to the water, and what health issues they developed. The Navy can then do one of three things: offer a settlement, deny the claim, or do nothing. If a settlement is offered, the person filing the claim can then accept it or litigate it. If an offer is not made within 6 months or the claim is denied, then the person can pursue litigation. Attorneys work with victims to file lawsuits. In February, when Camp Lejeune's victims could first file lawsuits, a name repeatedly popped up on the court documents: Attorney Eric Flynn with Bell Law Group, a firm out of South Carolina who has since opened an office in Raleigh to help handle the Camp Lejeune claims. "I couldn't be prouder to represent these clients," Flynn told McClatchy. "These people have suffered tremendously And I think it only takes talking to a handful of them, hearing their stories, to hear the suffering they went through. Bell Law Group's namesake, Edward Bell, began working with victims of Camp Lejeune more than 15 years ago. In the beginning, Flynn's firm tried to sue over the effects of the water, but ran into two hurdles: a time limit for how long after exposure someone could sue, and the government's immunity. Until the PAC Act, the law firm ran into roadblock after roadblock to get their clients justice. Flynn can rattle off their stories with ease. The women who suffered miscarriages while their husbands fought in Vietnam, the members of the military who developed neurological effects, the Marine with Parkinson's, the wife with multiple sclerosis, the divorces as medical problems and losses became too much for a couple to handle, the missing faces at family gatherings. There have been times when I think any attorney that has talked to these folks have walked out in tears because what these people have gone through is horrible, Flynn said. To be able to fight for these folks, to be able to bring their claim and hold people accountable, is extremely gratifying. Civil case could become largest in U.S. history. Flynn said that while the government lost sovereign immunity and the time limit constraints, officials still have a lot of arguments they can make. He said he won't predict what they'll do, but they could raise challenges based on the government's liability, on whether the water caused someone's health issues, or on the length of time they were exposed. On top of that, we still have to go through the process of getting experts to review all the documents, picking the juries, getting in front of the jury, convincing the jury of our case, etc., etc., Flynn said. Catherine Dunham, a professor of law at Elon Law School, told McClatchy that the largest civil case in U.S. history saw 300,000 claims filed due to 3M military earplugs. Camp Lejeune's claims are expected to far exceed that number. Despite victims being scattered worldwide now and attorneys as far away as at least Puerto Rico fighting for their business, is not multi-district, meaning all of the lawsuits are being filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. District Judge James Denver, make that James Deaver, told parties in March that he would handle the cases expeditiously. If he were to handle each lawsuit filed so far individually, it would take four judges 1,900 years, Public Radio East reported. We don't have a court system that could ever hear all these cases, Dunham said. Finding a lawyer. Meanwhile, victims of Camp Lejeune's toxic waters still need to navigate finding a lawyer. Once the PAC Act passed, Congress commercials flooded the airwaves for lawyers who could help secure money for people who lived on the base and even off base. The honest-to-God truth is if they don't advertise, then no, the injured people aren't going to know what to do, Dunham said. But she understands that some of the commercials leave people uneasy. I'll tell you what my philosophy is that the justice system has to be available, Dunham said. You have to have access points for regular people because it's always regular people who are injured. Dunham said if that means lawyers need to flood television to reach these who are injured, so be it. She added that someone is at greater risk of being taken advantage of if they walk into a random attorney's office who doesn't have experience but wants to go after a few claimants so they can take his share of the settlement. Flynn said it's important that people aren't victimized once again, this time by the lawyers. Through the process, Bell Law Group does not advertise on television. Flynn said to do your homework on law firms, call around and ask to talk to attorneys to see if they're the right fit. The good ones will do that, and you should be able to speak to somebody that you just click with and feel like this person really knows what they're talking about, Flynn said. Commercials predicting a specific payout amount have frustrated Flynn. It's impossible for a lawyer to make that promise, since none of these cases have been heard and there's no precedent. In the original draft of the bill to help Camp Lejeune water victims, lawmakers included a 25% cap on attorneys' fees so that lawyers couldn't take advantage of their clients. That cap was taken out before the PACT Act passed into law. Bloomberg reported in March that Bell Law Group spent more money than any other legal firm lobbying federal lawmakers over the past 2 years, and one of its requests was for the cap to be removed. Bell said he wouldn't object to a cap, but believed lawyers should be able to charge up to 40%, Bloomberg reported. When asked about the cap, Flynn said the legislation was supposed and supported by an overwhelming and bipartisan majority of senators and representatives. We too support the law as enacted and are eager for those veterans and their families to finally get the justice they have long been entitled to, Flynn said. Eisenmenger told McClatchy he had felt that years ago Bell, who he had previously recommended to people like Palumbo, took advantage of Eisenmenger's connections to drive up business. Eisenmenger has since cut ties with that firm and is now working with Michael Watts out of Texas. Despite that and the attorney's fees, Palumbo said he is grateful to the Bell Group for helping him navigate through the legal system. Cancer after drinking, cooking, and bathing in poisonous water. Jeff Frueler, 57, a Townsville resident, also said he was thankful to the law firm as he navigates the long legal process ahead of him. Like the Palumbos, Frueler had no idea he drank, cooked with, and bathed in poisonous water while stationed at the Marine base in the 1980s. Almost immediately after leaving the military, he began noticing neurological problems doctors could not explain. Anxiety, depression, irritability, poor concentration, and changes in his mood and personality. Frueler did receive a letter in the early 2000s from the U.S. government warning that he had been exposed to toxins at Camp Lejeune, but details in the letter were sparse, and Frueler dismissed it. It was a very generic letter that held very little information, Frueler said. Then things got serious. In 2012, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, Frueler said, at a very young age, according to my urologist. Frueler underwent a robotic prostatectomy the week of Thanksgiving. The surgery was a success, and the issues taken from around his prostate, that is, the tissues taken from around his prostate, came back negative for any spread. Initially, Froehlich had to return to his doctor every 2 weeks to ensure the cancer did not return. He now goes once a year. "I was still in the dark," Froehlich told McClatchy. "I mean, there was really no information out there that could tie everything together. The cancer that I had to the chemicals until a few years ago." But as Eisminger continued to work, word reached Floyer, who said that as more information surfaced, the more he could connect both his neurological ailments and his cancer to the toxin exposure. "Continuing to do the research and reading stuff, I mean, it all just started making a little bit more sense," Froehlich said. What happens next? In an emotional process for the Marines to come to terms with what happened and that the government was not upfront about it when officials first learned about the toxins, "I signed up to serve my country and I'll never regret it," Froehlich said. "What I do get emotional over is the fact that so much was done to cover this up, and it was some very hard work by a handful of people that wouldn't give up that brought all this to the surface. When we asked to join the military, when we were assigned to Camp Lejeune, we didn't have to get treated like this, to get poisoned like this by that water," Froehlich said. For Froehlich, there's always the question of what is next. "It's always in the back of my mind. As long as you're walking around with a ticking time bomb, and that's cancer, yeah, it's not a matter of is it going to go on or going to go off, but when it's going to go off. And what plays with your mind," Froehlich said, "is worrying about that time bomb." He said he had to compartmentalize that and push it to the back of his mind every day just to function. Then there's Palumbo. The illnesses didn't end with his wife. His oldest daughter, Kimberly, born on Camp Lejeune, died last June, just months before the PACT Act passed, at age 59. Like her mother, she suffered from a series of painful health conditions before her death. "I look back and I've said to myself many times, if I just didn't live in the village, rather than going to Tara Terrace, maybe my life would be different now," Palumbo said. "I don't know. I'm just following what God's put in my path and trying to do the best I can do with my children that I have now." Froehlich said he filed his lawsuit to lend a voice to those people like Palumbo, but also to look out for both himself and his daughter, because if another health issue arises because of the water, he doesn't know what to do. What do they do? And what we're only given until 2024 to figure it out. Here's another article from military.com. The title, "Fired Texas Army Commander Charged with Sex Abuse Faces Court-Martial." Posted 19 May 2023 by Steve Bainon. The former commander of 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Cavalry Division, was charged with sexually assaulting another officer's wife, according to documents reviewed by military.com. Colonel John Meredith, an armor officer, was arraigned Monday at Fort Cavazos, Texas, the base formerly known as Fort Hood, and faces a court-martial. Meredith has been charged with abusive sexual contact and conduct unbecoming an officer. Army documents say that Meredith touched the breasts, inner thighs, and genitals of another officer's civilian wife, with intent to arouse and gratify his and her desires in July. Meredith, a married man, also kissed her repeatedly and told her he wanted to have sex with her, the documents alleged. The Army has tried to be more aggressive in recent years, ousting soldiers who are accused of sexual assault and harassment, particularly after the gruesome 2020 slaying of Specialist Vanessa Gulyan at Fort Cavazos, which caught national attention and drew intense scrutiny from the media and Congress on how the service protects women. High-profile courts martial against colonels, particularly for sexual assault, are relatively rare. Last year, an Air Force general was convicted of sex abuse, making history as the first general in the service to be prosecuted by court-martial, Major General William Cooley. The former head of the Air Force Research Laboratory was accused by his sister-in-law of pinning her, kissing her, putting his hand on her breast, and then moving his hand between her legs after a brief drive following a family barbecue in 2018. The Meredith case, the court documents say, he went uninvited to the house of the woman while her Army officer husband was participating in a field training exercise. During that visit, he allegedly groped her and made sexual advances. Meredith was fired from his job in command in October 2022 after being at the helm since May 2021. His court-martial is set for October 18. Meredith is married to Colonel Ann Meredith, who was also ousted from her role commanding the 89th Military Police Brigade, also at Fort Cavazos in February. She initially took command of the brigade in July 22. In a social media post reviewed by military.com, Ann Meredith alleges she was initially suspended from command after sending a text message that was perceived as potentially influencing the investigation into her husband's conduct. The details of that text message could not be independently verified. Next article from our usual website, military.com, is entitled Group Accused of Making Up Story About Homeless Vets Being Evicted to Make Room for Migrants. Posted 20 May 2023 by Bobby Kana Calvin. Datemark, New York. The founder of a nonprofit group has been accused of fabricating a story about homeless military veterans being evicted from a New York hotel to make room for migrants. A tale that struck days of outrage on cable news networks. One Republican lawmaker in New York who helped spread the story is now calling for an investigation, saying he and others were duped. The uproar became after New York Mayor Eric Adams, a Democrat, bused a small group of asylum seekers to a suburban hotel as the city's homeless shelter system struggled to accommodate an influx of migrants from the U.S. border with Mexico. The group's transfer prompted a political backlash from Republican county officials. He accused the mayor of trying to offload his problems on unprepared communities. Then, the founder of a small charity in the area added an explosive claim. To make way for the migrants, a hotel in Newburgh, New York, evicted nearly two dozen homeless veterans. The story, told by Yerik Israel Tony Foundation Chief Executive Sharon Tony Finch, was picked up 12 May by the New York Post and quickly followed by Fox News, Newsmax, and other conservative news outlets. The Post on Friday published a follow-up story reporting on the latest development. Our veterans have been placed in another hotel due to what's going on with the immigrants, Tony Finch told the Post in its initial story, saying, her group has made arrangements to find alternative lodgings. We didn't waste any time. The Assemblyman Brian Maher, a Republican, introduced legislation that will prohibit the displacement of homeless veterans. In an appearance on Fox News, he called the purported evacuations an absolute embarrassment on all fronts. Cracks in the story emerged after an investigation by a local newspaper, the Mid-Hudson News. The manager of the hotel told the paper the story was not true. A receipt reported to show that the Crossroads Hotel had been paid $37,800 to house the veterans appeared to have been sloppily doctored. In a follow-up report Friday, the Mid-Hudson News reported that several men staying at a homeless shelter in Poughkeepsie, New York, had come forward to say they were recruited to pretend they were among the veterans kicked out of the hotel. The paper quoted some of the men as saying they were offered $200, food, and alcohol to take part in the ruse. They said they met with Tony Finch, then participated in a meeting at a veterans center in Orange County with local Chamber of Commerce officials. Tony Finch denied giving any money to the men. In a brief interview with the Associated Press, she declined to say directly that her story was not true, but she suggested that a misunderstanding may have led to confusion. We should have verified better, she said. She abruptly ended the phone call when pressed for details. Mayer said in a written statement that he had a conversation with Tony Finch on Thursday, where he learned that the story about homeless veterans being displaced was false. The YIT Foundation purports to protect and support veterans, but the dishonest claims and fabrication of the facts by YIT does enormous harm to our homeless veterans by creating mistrust, Mayer said, referring to the foundation by its shortened name. I am calling for an immediate investigation by the New York State Attorney General's office and the Orange County District Attorney into the YIT Foundation based on the new information that came to light today. While I believe Sharon was telling the truth, I do want to apologize for those that have been negatively impacted since this news broke, he added. New York City's mayor also called for an investigation into what he called a fraudulent claim. Instead of stepping up, we're seeing hateful language and outright lies, Adams said in a Twitter post. On its website, the Yerik Israel Tony Foundation advertises its focus as helping raise awareness of premature births and assisting families with transportation and lodging while their infants are in neonatal intensive care units. It also says it helps hopeless and low-income military service veterans in need of living assistance. New York says more than 65,000 migrants have arrived in the city over the past year, with the first of them bussed by Republican governors in border states to draw attention to their displeasure over federal border policy. policies. Yet another article from military.com is entitled, U.S. will train Ukrainians on F-16 fighter jet after months of speculation. Posted 19 May 2023 by Konstantin Toropin. The U.S. and its allies will begin training Ukrainians on F-16 fighting Falcon fighter jets after months of lobbying and request from Kiev, the latest in the effort to help the Western-style democracy fend off a Russian invasion. President Joe Biden broke the news to world leaders at the Group of Seven summit in Japan on Friday, according to a U.S. official with knowledge of the decision, and the move was hailed by the U.K. and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky on social media. The U.S. will support a joint effort with our allies and partners to train Ukrainian pilots on fourth-generation fighter aircraft, including F-16s, to further strengthen and improve the capabilities of the Ukrainian Air Force, the U.S. told military.com in an email. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak praised the announcements in a tweet, saying his country will work together with the USA and the Netherlands, Belgium and Denmark to get Ukraine the combat air capability it needs. Zelensky said that he welcomed this historic decision and that it will greatly enhance our army in the sky. The leader of Ukraine, known for his forceful stand against Russian President Vladimir Putin's onslaught and his signature olive drab outfits, was expected to participate in the meeting of leaders in Japan on Sunday, according to the Associated Press. I count on discussing the practical implementation of this decision at the G7 summit in Hiroshima, he added in a tweet. The U.S. official said it would be up to the countries that are participating in the training to decide when to actually provide jets, how many we will provide, and who will provide them. Ukraine's interest in foreign fighter jets goes back for months. In April, the country's Air Force tweeted about the idea, saying that its greatest need is for fighter jets, F-15s and F-16s, of the fourth generation or higher, would be sufficient. Another Ukrainian Air Force official went so far as to rebuff the Americans' idea of sending the older A-10 Warthog, telling military.com that those planes would not close our sky. They would not stop bombers and missiles. In July, the U.S. Air Force top official, General Charge C.Q. Brown, said that officials were indeed considering the training. I do believe that we have an aspect and a responsibility like we do with all our allies and partners to be prepared to train them in various capabilities and capacities, Brown told the Aspen Security Forum in Colorado. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, also said the possibility was being considered around the same time. In March, NBC reported, citing two congressional officials and a senior U.S. official, that two Ukrainian pilots came to the U.S. to be tested to see how long it would take to train them to fly attack aircraft, including F-16 fighter jets. However, experts who spoke to military.com were skeptical that it would be a simple matter of just a few classes. One Air Force veteran pilot said, supplying and training Ukrainians on the planes would be nothing short of a Herculean effort. General James Hecker, the head of the U.S. Air Force in Europe, as well as Air Forces Africa and Allied Command, told Military.com in March that he's not surprised by the request for the modern jets, but doubts the aircraft's ability to repel Moscow's invasion. I think it's going to help them a little bit, Heckler said. I don't think it's going to be a game changer. Those concerns were similar to the issues raised when Ukrainians asked for another major U.S. weapon platform, the Abrams tank. Colin Kael, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, told reporters in January that the Abrams tank is a very complicated piece of equipment. It's expensive, it's hard to train on, it's not the easiest system to maintain, Kael said at the time. It may or may not be the right system. There were also concerns about supplying the fuel-hungry gas turbine engines used to power the main battle tank. A 1992 Government Accountability Office report found that during the first Gulf War, Abrams crews were impressed with the power and performance of the Abrams turbine engine, but they were concerned about its high fuel consumption and the need to frequently clean air filters in the sandy desert environment. Refueling was a constant concern, the report added. Despite these reservations, Ukrainian troops are set to start training on the tanks in Germany in the next couple of weeks, and the Pentagon aims to have 31 Abrams in the country by the fall. Now comes an interesting article from Military.com titled, After Marines' Testimony, Republicans Seek Answers from Pentagon on Bombing During Afghanistan Withdrawal, posted 19 May 2023 by Rebecca Cahill. Top House lawmakers want the Pentagon to give more details on the lead-up to a suicide bombing outside Afghanistan's Kabul airport in 2021 that killed 13 U.S. troops, following testimony from Marine who claimed to have identified the bomber before the attack. Sergeant Tyler Vargas Andrews, a Marine Corps sniper, who testified to the House Foreign Affairs Committee in March, said he couldn't get approval from his chain of command to shoot the terrorist, who was killed in what became known as the Abbey Gate bombing during the military's chaotic withdrawal from the country. Plain and simple, we were ignored, Vargas Andrews, whose leg and arm were amputated after attack, said at the hearing. In a letter released Thursday afternoon, House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, Republican of Alabama, and Foreign Affairs Chairman Mike McCaul, Republican of Texas, asked for a slew of documents related to that bombing. Battlefield decisions are often made in a cloud, but in honor of the lives lost and those still living following that terrible day, it is incumbent we learn whether events were avoidable and if uncertain procedures, broken lines of communication, or worse, contributed to the lack of engagement. Rogers and McCaul wrote in a letter to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley. A Pentagon spokesman declined to comment to Military.com about the letter, saying in an email that, as with all congressional correspondence, we will reply directly to the authors of the letter. McCaul has been leading an investigation into withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 that saw the U.S. military rush to evacuate as many vulnerable Afghans as possible after the U.S.-backed government in Kabul fell to the Taliban. In March, McCall's committee held an emotional public hearing, kicking off the investigation into which service members and veterans who helped with the evacuation recounted their experience. Citing the testimony, Rogers and McCall requested the Pentagon provided all documents and communications about the Abbey Gate bombing by June 2nd, including any intelligence about the identity of the attackers, the rules of engagement in effect at the time of the bombing, any video or photographs from the day of the attack, and any messages or chats about threats to the Kabul airport. The pair also asked for a detailed description of the response to Vargas Andrews' request for engagement authority. Testimony during the hearing raises serious questions regarding the events leading up to the attack, which must be answered, the lawmakers wrote. The military investigation into the Abbey Gate bombing concluded it was not preventable, despite indications of threats to the airport beforehand. Vargas Andrews testified at the hearing that he has never been interviewed as part of any Pentagon investigation into the withdrawal. Rogers and McCall also asked for documents related to the Pentagon's after-action review of the withdrawal. The Biden administration allowed lawmakers to see the classified review, but publicly has released only a White House summary that largely pins blame for the chaos on the withdrawal on the Trump administration. The lawmakers specifically asked the Pentagon to provide the footnotes from the after-action review, which they said were redacted in the version given to Congress, as well as transcripts of interviews done for the review. The letter to the Pentagon comes after McCall's standoff with the State Department over his Afghanistan withdrawal investigation eases, at least for now. In March, McCall issued a subpoena demanding the State Department hand over a document known as a dissent cable that was written by diplomats and reportedly warned Kabul would soon fall to the Taliban. McCall was planning a vote next week to hold Secretary of State Antony Blinken in contempt of Congress, as the department withheld the document over stated concerns that providing the cable would violate the confidentiality of the diplomats who sent it. But on Wednesday, the department offered to let McCall and Representative Gregory Meeks, Democrat of New York, the ranking member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, view the cable under supervision at the State Department with personal information about the senders redacted. McCall accused the Army Tuesday and said he would postpone next week's contempt vote, but he added that he still wants other community members to be able to see the cable and reserves the right to enforce the subpoena. Well, that's going to be about all we have time and room for in this edition of Military News from the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Again, this is Bob Mallon. Most of our news, if not all, seems to come from military.com, which I would recommend to you to read on your own. Again, good night, take care of each other, and we'll talk again next time.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303 786-7777.